Are you ready?
Friday, Friday, Friday. Get 'em out by Friday.
Friday night.
Got that Friday night fever.
Yes, Friday. Woo!
Welcome to First Amendment Friday on the Lars Larson Show.
Friday is for everybody.
Today, Lars puts you in the driver's seat. You talk about what you want to talk about.
Government is the problem.
No topic is off limits.
It looks like the Canadians are here.
866-HEY-LARS. That's 866-HEY-LARS.
Thinking it's Friday. Happy Friday.
This is
First Amendment Friday with Lars Larson.
Welcome back to the Lars Larson Show. It's First Amendment Friday, and I want to start off by suggesting that we are far too easy on teenage criminals. Now, not all teenage criminals, but I'm going to give you an example of a couple of so-called teenagers. They are from Honduras. They happen to be operating in the Pacific Northwest, and you know what they're doing? They are running an adult-level fentanyl distribution business. And when I say adult-level, I mean when the police catch you with 170,000 fentanyl pills. Remember, those pills are the kind that not only sell for a lot of money, not individually, but they make a lot of money by selling them, but they're also potentially deadly to an awful lot of the people who take the drugs. So you've got two teenagers doing this. And what are they doing? They're taking advantage of the fact that in the United States of America, we tend to have a very sympathetic view. Now, the police know this. They know we're going to arrest these kids. We're going to charge them. Nothing much is going to happen to them. And then they're going to be released and they're going to go right back out and start doing it again. And let me tell you what they were doing. Well, I'll get into the details of that in a moment. First, it's First Amendment Friday, and I'm always glad to take your calls. First Amendment Friday is always my favorite day of the week because we open up the phone lines. That involves a certain amount of risk for me. I'm glad to take naysayers because of the naysayer calls and says, Lars, you're completely wrong. We should still be sympathetic to illegal aliens or sympathetic to juvenile criminals or sympathetic to Iran. I mean, there are an amazing number of Democrats who appear to be pro-Iran these days. And then, of course, there's an awful lot of mainstream media like CNN that literally lies. In fact, one of the Babylon Bee headlines today was maybe CNN should start doing simultaneous retractions along with its stories. And why is that? They had two anchors this week who announced that the bombs thrown outside the home of the Muslim communist mayor of New York City, Zohran Mamdani, that those bombs were attacks on Zohran Mamdani. They were not. They were attacks on the mayor's critics. They were not attacks against the Muslim mayor of New York City. They were attacks against the people who are legally and lawfully protesting against the idea of a Muslim mayor and a Muslim takeover of America's biggest city. But CNN went ahead and said it anyway, and then they had to retract it later. And the next day, a different anchor on CNN did the same kind of thing. So if you assume that you're always getting, you know, the God's honest truth, just consider the source. When it comes to the Chicken Noodle News Network, and that's CNN, you're not likely getting the truth, at least not all of the time. But if you want to join the best conversation in talk journalism, it's here every day at 866-HEY-LARS. That's 866-439-5277. Send your emails to talk@LarsLarson.com. And if you're a naysayer, we put you right to the head of the line. You can also vote in our X poll. And today's question for a Friday, you know, Mackenzie Prunty, one of my great producers, the executive producer of the program, came up with this one. If you serve yourself at a business, now it could be a restaurant, could be one of the coffee stands, could be Starbucks, could be Dutch Bros. If you're serving yourself, should you be expected to tip the people who are working as paid employees of that company? Whether it's a coffee counter, whether it's a convenience store, is a tip appropriate when you're the one? The customer is buying it. The customer is ordering it. The customer is doing self-service. Do you end up still giving a tip to whoever happens to be standing there watching while you pay for the service? And my answer to that would be no. And in fact, the story quotes J.J. Watt, the former NFL star. He got a real debate going because he questioned whether or not he should have to tip in a self-service scenario. He asked his followers what they would do. You order at a counter, you find your own table, you fill your own coffee, you retrieve your own food when a buzzer goes off, and then you have an iPad screen asking you, would you like to tip 20%, 25%, 30%, or something even bigger than that? I think it's a perfectly reasonable question to ask. You can find the question at Lars Larson Show and at LarsLarson.com, and brought to you by Ultimate Truck Services. If you rely on trucks for business, Ultimate keeps your biggest assets on the road and running right. Find them at UltimateTruckService.com. Now, let me go back to the teenage fentanyl ring. I mean, teenagers have been involved in crime, I'm sure, as long as human societies have been around, so thousands of years. But lately, societies, especially America's society, has decided we've got to go easy on those teenage criminals. So consider this. You've got two teenagers, 16 and 17. They are from the country of Honduras. Now, because it's one of those Daily Dead fish wrapper newspapers, they don't mention, are these two in the country legally? Were they allowed in during the giant flood of illegal aliens during President Otopen or what? They don't explain any of that, nor do they explain why, when they were caught the first time, 2 years ago, they weren't immediately sent right back to Honduras. But they were arrested in 2024. At that point, they were small-level fentanyl dealers. They only had about 20,000 fentanyl pills and $65,000 in cash on them. And then they were allegedly prosecuted in juvenile court for the drug possession, and then they were cut loose after a few months. It's funny, because they say, you know, the cops involved in this, the prosecutors involved, say these are not two children that made an immature mistake. This is a quote. They are hardened fentanyl drug dealers who continue to be released and will poison the community until they turn 18 and are sentenced as adults. So guess what? They just caught them a second time. So the DEA, not local police, but the Trump Drug Enforcement Administration, raided the home. And they found even more drugs. They found 40 pounds of fentanyl in pill and powdered form. They found thousands of dollars. All of this, and these two are still 16 and 17 years of age, and yet they continue to be prosecuted. Apparently, there is an uncle to these two cousins from Honduras, who is masterminding their operation from the country of Mexico. And Louis Burkhardt is the man I was just quoting, the assistant U.S. attorney, because you're not going to see prosecutors here in the Pacific Northwest. I mean, the Seattle area, the Portland area, do you really think you're going to get hardcore treatment of hardcore drug dealers? No, they're going to let them keep on dealing, even though we all know that when Oregon foolishly legalized hard drugs in ballot measure 110, and when the state of Washington saw all of its hard drug laws wiped out by a very liberal state Supreme Court, that thousands of people started dying of drug overdoses as a result of those policies, which made the Pacific Northwest a great place to sell illegal drugs. So you've got an uncle down in Mexico. He's got two of these kids, 16 and 17-year-olds from Honduras. They're in Portland, and they're selling hundreds of thousands of fentanyl pills, and they're apparently making bank. Like I said, the first time they caught them, these two teenagers had $65,000 in cash. And you know what? The two teenagers even had some adults who were working as their employees in their drug business, but they knew the legal system wouldn't touch them. It's First Amendment Friday, and you've got the Lars Larson Show.
Surrounded by Northwest liberals.
I cannot stand these morons any longer. If you don't come with me this instant, I shall run amok.
Come to the place where common sense prevails. The Lars Larson Show.
That makes a lot of sense. A lot of nonsense.
Right. You're bloody well right. You know you got a right to sit.
This is the Northwest Nonsense.
How much longer do we have to sit for this nonsense?
That great moment every day where Lars brings you the cold, hard facts without any liberal wokeness from the Daily Dead fish wrapper or mainstream media bias.
You know, if you want a quick preview of the multi-billion dollar disaster that's coming at us if the Interstate 5 bridge project actually goes forward, look no further than ODOT's Abernathy Bridge boondoggle near Oregon City. There's there's an update this week, and it's not a good one. The Oregon Department of Transportation lied to lawmakers about 8 years ago and said, we can build the new bridge. It's only going to cost $250 million. ODOT didn't have the money, but they went forward with the project anyway. I know it sounds crazy, but that system has worked for ODOT for a long time. Just go in, lowball the bid, lie to the people's representatives, and get the project started. Once it gets started, there's no turning back, and nobody ever gets fired. Today, the project has spent more than twice its original cost, $500 million, and the bridge is only 70% done. Like that kitchen remodel contractor from hell, telling you that your cost has now tripled, but your house is already torn apart. So you have two choices, pay up or live in chaos. But for all that money, now an estimated $800 million, more than triple the original cost, at least it'll be finished on time, right? Wrong. Originally, contractor Kiewit was supposed to be done with the entire project by the end of last year, which ODOT then agreed to extend to October of this year. And now Kiewit says they may be done by January of 2028, almost 2 years from now. But remember, that's a contractor promise, and I wouldn't exactly take it to the bank. Your calls are welcome on a First Amendment Friday at 866-HEY-LARS. So thanks for listening on the Radio Northwest Network. And if you want to send emails, it's talk@LarsLarson.com. Our question of the day, brought to you by Multnomah Medical Clinic. No pills, no shots, no surgery, and get better fast at Multnomah Medical Clinic. Anthony Grant writes in, Lars, greetings from Bonner County, Idaho. I was hoping you could give a special thanks and shout-out to the ever-underappreciated, hardworking men and women servicing our power infrastructure. North Idaho, Eastern Washington, and Western Montana have been hit multiple times with widespread outages over the last few years caused by storms. I see these guys, and I would add gals to that, out immediately every time in all manner of nasty weather, clearing trees, replacing power poles, and restringing lines. Crews are even brought in from other regions to help out. Just like our firefighters, cops, first responders in the military, I feel these guys deserve a solid salute. They don't get recognized near enough. Signed, Anthony. Now, you're going to hear me complain a lot about the state of the power grid, but that's not up to the individual line men and line women out there. They put the wires back up after the storms and the other calamities. They don't decide how the grid is engineered. That is the people up in the C-suite, and it's often the people in the state legislature. My favorite post on X today, if the governor's political position, that is Tina Kotek, is as vulnerable as some suggest, why hasn't a serious challenger emerged? Because Oregon is a Democrat machine state, and in a political machine, you don't challenge the higher-ups. Plus, the boss might just get mad at you. But it is a bit of a mystery. You've got Tina Kotek now ranking as one of the least popular governors in all 50 states, 58 if you're an Obama voter. You've got her not endorsed this year, as usual, by the teachers' unions or the working party's family. They can't even tolerate her, and yet her own political party will not say, this is a failed candidate, we need to replace her with someone else. No, they're going to give you Tina Kotek again, and it's your job as voters to go to the polls in November and choose somebody better, and you'll have a bunch of choices to choose from. And now today's Daily Grill.
Insane.
Are you
ridiculous.
They get more and more ridiculous.
Flat out dumb.
You're even dumber than I thought.
Who deserves today's Lars Grill of the Day?
Maybe they're just really, really stupid.
Presented by Oregon City Garage Door.
Well, if you ever thought that the big blue cities of the Pacific Northwest could not get more woke than they are already, let me give you the latest example. There is a small public park in the city of Portland that was called Custer Park. I know, it was named after the general. Yeah, General George Custer, who led the Battle of the Little Bighorn. Well, fact is, that's not politically correct. So they have renamed it in a Native American language. I couldn't even find out how many people actually speak this language. In fact, I can't even pronounce it. It is spelled I-C-H-I-S-K-I-N. It looks like, well, my spell checker actually changed it to itchy skin, but I'm pretty sure that's not it. S-N-W-I-T. The language is apparently spoken by Native American tribes along the Columbia River. So they have renamed Custer Park to be, and again, I'm going to have to spell it out, S-C-H-T, that's the first word, W-I-W-N-U. I guess the pronunciation, according to the fish wrapper, is Ishchit Weyelnu. Ishchit Weyelnu. You got to rename the park because God knows you can't have Custer's name on a park. Your best emails are always welcome at talk@LarsLarson.com. And the best one so far today, I had to leave the name off of it, but it's fascinating. It has to do with Washington State's Labor and Industries, a state agency that is supposed to look out for workers in the state of Washington. And what he writes is, I was made aware of some downright ridiculous spending practices at Washington Labor and Industries. Apparently, L&I bought a new fleet of electric trucks for their inspectors and their employees, but they have no charging stations available at the L&I facilities. So they opted not to install the chargers at the employees' personal houses. So to keep the vehicles charged, the employees now drive to various charging locations, and they sit there on the clock while their vehicle charges. And then once full, they proceed to go out and do their work duties. I've heard they use Alena Casino as one of their charging locations. I wonder if the tribes know the state of Washington is stealing their electricity. So not only are electric vehicles a waste of money, now L&I employees are just collecting an hourly wage to watch them charge up. You can't make this up. Love your show. Listen to it every day. I'll tell you what. I would love to hear from L&I, and we're going to see if we can get somebody from L&I. Is it true you bought a bunch of electric trucks but didn't bother to install the charging stations, so now you just have somebody go out on the clock making wages to sit in a vehicle, a man or woman, sitting in a vehicle watching the vehicle charge up at what, $25, $30, $40 an hour? Sounds like a wonderful use of the taxpayers' money. It's First Amendment Friday, and you're listening to the Radio Northwest Network.
The Lars Larson Show. Something to say? Give Lars a call at 866-HEY-LARS. That's 866-HEY-LARS. Now, back to the Lars Larson Show.
Welcome back to the program. We even made this today's X Poll. As you know, on this program, we put up a brand new poll question every day. You can find it at Lars Larson Show and on our website at LarsLarson.com. And it's a very simple question. If you serve yourself and you do all the work, that is, you fill up your own coffee, grab your own food, and then all of a sudden you're asked for a tip. Do you think that a tip ought to be offered? And my answer to that is no. But I thought I'd put the question to Nick Neonakis, who is CEO of the Franchise Consulting Company. Nick, welcome to the program.
Hey, Lars. Great to be on.
Hey, I take it that your company is the kind that goes out and helps out people with franchises or people thinking of franchising and says, here's how to do it, and here are the pitfalls and the tripwires?
That's right. Yeah, the pitfalls and pratfalls of franchising. And, you know, we've been in business 24 years. We've got about 200 offices around the country, and we work with hundreds of different franchise brands. And so the question about tipping is one near and dear to my heart. And we are really facing the axis of evil right now when it comes to this question, because you've got tipflation, shrinkflation, and inflation all hitting at the same time. And people are very unhappy about the tips that they're being, forced to pay.
Yeah, and in fact, it is kind of a social forcing of things where you roll up, you order a cup of coffee, all the person does is take the order, and then somebody else makes the coffee, which is not that terribly all-consuming, and then they come back and say, would you like to tip 20, 25, 30%, and they put a screen in your face, and frankly, I've said no. I'm not tipping you for taking the order and handing me the product. But there are other examples where you literally do your own food service, find your own table, do all the work, and then they want you to give a tip as well. Where did that expectation come from? Do you know?
I do, actually. So we got to go all the way back to 2008 when Starbucks and their baristas were in a massive lawsuit. And what it centered around was the tip jar was being distributed to frontline supervisory staff. And California found Starbucks guilty of, you know, giving managers tips that were supposed to go to the workers. And it was $100 million claim. Okay, so they ended up settling it. But part of what they did was they said, instead of a jar with cash in it, we're going to put the tips on our Square platform. So Starbucks had invested into Square. And that's when you started seeing the, you know, 15, 20, 25%, or even better with coffee, $1, $2, $3. So a $1 tip on a $3.85 cup of coffee is 26%. Now, here's where it really gets interesting. The way the Fair Labor Standards Act works is if an employee is getting minimum wage and they're getting tips, there's a portion of that that the employer doesn't have to pay on. So the employers are incentivized for the employees to generate tips. They don't have to pay as much taxes. Square or Toast, Clover, okay, the three main point of sale systems, make their money on getting a percentage of the revenue that goes through there. So they're getting a piece of the tips. And then the employees make more money. So now you've got three groups of people that are colluding to shake you down. And the messenger of this is a pimply-faced 17-year-old kid that, Lars, when you say, I'm not giving you a tip, that icy stare is going to just hurt you.
And yeah, in fact, right now, Nick, I got to tell you, there's one of the coffee places I like because I think Starbucks burns their beans, and I favor Dutch Bros. And I go in there and they show me the screen, and then they started saying totally voluntary. Yes, deciding to give you a couple of bucks for buying a cup of coffee for a couple of bucks is totally voluntary. But I think they were trying to soften the blow, but somebody had to push that button, and I thought, boy, I'd hate to be the kid who's doing that. You're asking, would you like to give me a tip? You've put in your order. You haven't even received the coffee yet. And in a couple of cases, we got a cold cup of coffee, my wife and I. And I thought, I already gave a tip for a dollar for service I hadn't received yet, which seems really stupid.
Well, you know, and if you don't tip, what might come back in the cup of coffee is always the fear. Maybe it's not cold. Maybe it comes with a little extra, you know, love. But, you know, the other thing that people get crazy about is when they're automatically adding the service charge. At least here, you've got the right to say no. But when they add a service charge and there's a tip line underneath it, a lot of people don't actually read what their receipt is. And now they're getting hit with an 18% service charge plus the tip.
No, that makes no sense. And Nick, the thing that's always bugged me, my wife and I have always tipped generously for good service, you know, for above and beyond. And yet what drives me nuts is this sharing of tips, because there are times I've walked into a business, you know, usually a store like that, coffee store, food store, and you get really lousy service from one person, but somebody else gives you very good service. I'd like to tip that person, except I know that because of this collectivism they have, this junior socialism they have, they say, you know, whether you're the nasty employee that nobody wants to talk to at all, you know, or the very nice employee who gives service above and beyond, you all get an equal share of the tips, which I really resent. I'm almost ready to say, I don't want to tip at all if I'm going to share the tip with this person over here who's not a very good employee and doesn't give very good service. Is that too Neanderthal of me?
No, but I think, you know, it's in response to this Trotsky-esque, you know, cabal that is working in restaurants. And what's going on is the service quality continues to go down. Because in the past, I mean, when we were kids, right, you probably worked in a restaurant. I did too. You knew that if you gave great service, you were going to get a tip. And it was probably going to be in cash and you'd put it in your pocket. But now, because it's electronic and everybody's sharing in it, what incentive does somebody have to give great service? Either they're going to tip or they're not. And if they do, it's going to go into the pool. So I think the more insidious thing that's happening is it is causing service levels to go down. And you're seeing that everywhere. And it's a shame.
Well, and the other thing is, Nick, when all these jurisdictions have decided we want minimum wages at $16 to $20 an hour, in other words, full-time work of serving coffee is going to pay the equivalent of $40,000 a year full-time. That doesn't make any sense to me. And then the product reflects that in the price of the product, and then you're expected to tip on top of that. I mean, none of that really makes sense to me. Nick, thanks very much. That's Nick Neonakis. He is CEO of the Franchise Consulting Company, and this does form the basis of today's X-Poll. You can find the question at Lars Larson Show and at LarsLarson.com. If you are serving yourself and you're bringing your own coffee, picking your own table, picking up your own food, and to some extent even cleaning up your own mess, then should you leave a tip at all? My answer to that is no. Back in a moment. You've got First Amendment Friday on the Lars Larson Show and the Radio Northwest Network.
Disagree with Lars? Great. Naysayers go first at 866-HEY-LARS. Now, back to the Lars Larson Show.
Hey, welcome back to the Lars Larson Show, live on the Radio Northwest Network. And, of course, it is First Amendment Friday. Glad to get your calls at 866-HEY-LARS. That's 866-439-5277. Send your emails to talk@LarsLarson.com. This segment of the program is brought to you by 540training.com. Concealed carry, home invasion defense, and personal defense. Find them online at 540training.com. Our X-Poll question, if you serve yourself, should you be expected to pay a tip? My answer to that is no. You can find the question at Lars Larson Show, and brought to you by Ultimate Truck Services. If you rely on trucks for business, Ultimate keeps your biggest assets on the road and running right. Find them at ultimatetruckservice.com. Let me go first to John. Hey, John, it's First Amendment Friday. What's on your mind? Hey, John.
Hello, Lars. Can you hear me?
Yes, sir.
Okay. Well, first off, I want to thank you for your show and all the knowledge that you supply the rest of us around here in the Pacific Northwest.
My pleasure.
I do want to talk about the military loss that we just had with the refueling accident.
The KC-135 that went down, very sad, 6 lives lost in that. And we had, I believe, 6 other service members who have died, and a couple of hundred who've been injured or wounded since the beginning of the attacks on Iran.
That is correct. So I served in 1991. I was a ranger, Army Ranger. And
wow, rangers lead the way.
And I know that's where my point comes from. My point comes from I have never really witnessed or seen any accident or deaths from a refueling accident. So I don't really know if I believe 100% that it was just an accident. I know friendly fire wasn't involved, but
they're also saying, John, at this point, the latest reports, believe them or not, it was not friendly fire and it was not enemy fire. It was something else, and they haven't explained yet. And it may be they don't truly know for sure. So what should they tell us?
So, well, do you believe? I believe 100% it's not friendly fire. I don't think it was a refueling accident. I've been on the plane that's refueled. I've been on a plane that was refueled.
What, John? I have had the same experience, not because of military service, but I've been on a helicopter that was being refueled from a KC-135. I've also been on the refueling plane. And I asked one of the pilots of the helicopter in this case, I said, how far is that hose from your rotor blades? And now, of course, they were refueling mostly fixed wing over Iran. And he said 12 feet. And I said, that doesn't leave you a lot of margin for error. And he said, no, it doesn't. So is it possible it was an accident?
Well, now I know it's only 12 feet, but we haven't had any accidents. We've had some fuel leaks. We've had some misguide, but we had never had a tragedy like this. This is what we're good at. This is what we do. We train for this.
On the other hand, if you're training for it, but now you're in the skies and the pilot is having to respond to all kinds of threats outside as well. You know, not necessarily fire that hits your aircraft, but if you say we're going to have to move quickly, is it possible that that and doing it at night might actually lead to the kind of accident in real wartime conditions that don't happen in routine training?
I would agree that is correct. I mean, I would say in routine training, you know, it's just training, but this is real life, and we are in a battle, and we are refueling jets and cargo planes.
What do you think brought the plane down then, John?
You know, I just, that's what my call is about, Lars. My call is, we haven't had a tragedy like this from a refueling accident, even on a 12-foot hose.
Okay, but John, the fact that we haven't had that kind of accident before, does it mean we never will under real life conditions? Because then what are you suggesting brought it down?
A conspiracy. I just am saying that I think it wasn't friendly fire for sure, and it wasn't an accident from the United States. I just think there was something on the side, something we missed.
Okay, I'll tell you what, if we get any evidence of that, I'd be glad to go to it. Let's go to Matt, who's a naysayer. Hey, Matt, you know we love naysayers. What do you and I disagree about?
It's funny. I never thought I would be a naysayer on your show, but I wanted to defend this tipping thing a little bit from a business owner standpoint. I have a small franchise, and for the longest time, the franchise told us we are not allowed to accept tips in any sense, because what it does is it adds, you know, 20% to their product, and they don't want to be seen as, you know, because it actually does add a certain amount of percentage to their sale, and they want to keep their sale down. However, I have customers every single day that want to give, you know, to the kids, you know. What can I do?
Well, that should be their choice, right, Matt?
Absolutely, absolutely.
And no, but I'm not saying prohibit the tips. I'm just saying when you go to the kind of place where you find your own table, you walk up and order your food, you go up and pick up your food and bring it to your table, you may even pour your own drink if it's soda pop, and you say, who am I tipping and why? Because I did all the work. I did most of the work.
Absolutely. But from my standpoint as a small business owner, see, when COVID hit, all of a sudden, I couldn't hire any employees. I mean, it was ridiculously difficult to hire employees. So the franchise said, oh, you know what? We're going to enter this ball game of tips. We are going to start allowing our credit card machines to do tips. What they did is they said they put other. You can put other, which means you can put 2 cents, you can put 5 cents. They didn't add all these percentages on there. They did have a 10% one. And then, you know, and you can opt out with just the X button. But what that did is I went from having this little tip jar where I'd get about $18 a day.
Yeah.
All of a sudden, I'm getting $200-$300 a day.
I know, but Matt, money here's part of the problem. Matt, here's part of the problem. I just passed a birthday. Do you think I went to any of my friends or family and said, by the way, here's what I want for my birthday? Do you think I asked for a gift?
No.
Have you ever asked for a gift?
No.
Is a gratuity a gift?
It can be, actually.
No, it is nothing. If otherwise, it's income. If it's not a gift, then it's income. So when you have employees at your business saying, hey, would you like to give me a gift because I did the service really well? Asking for tips seems to me like asking for birthday presents. Matt, very good call. Thanks so much. You got the Lars Larson Show and the Radio Northwest Network.
The Lars Larson Show. To First Amendment Friday on the Lars Larson Show.
Friday is for everybody.
Today, Lars puts you in the driver's seat. You talk about what you want to talk about.
Government is the problem.
No topic is off limits.
They look like the Canadians are here.
Boo!
Oh,
866-HEY-LARS. That's 866-HEY-LARS.
Thank goodness it's Friday. Happy Friday. Friday.
This is
First Amendment Friday with Lars Larson.
Welcome back to the Lars Larson Show. It's a pleasure to be with you, and I want to get to your phone calls and emails. It's First Amendment Friday. You know, I think all of us have been watching the reports out of a state, Minnesota, where allegedly there's been as much as $18 or $19 billion worth of social welfare fraud. And you say, well, it's just Minnesota. Now, every time you see something like that happening in a blue state like Minnesota, I always suspect it may be happening here in the Pacific Northwest as well. It's just that the authorities in Oregon and Washington seem to be a bit better at covering these kinds of things up. And one of the guys who's been writing about that lately is Jeff Eager, former mayor of Bend, attorney, political consultant. And you can find what he writes at Oregon Roundup on Substack. Jeff, welcome back.
Great to be here, Lars.
Am I right to suspect, because you've written about one particular case where just one treatment facility, not even a facility, a house, a single house, where allegedly they were doing substance abuse counseling, the fancy name for drug treatment right now, that they had handed out, they being the state of Oregon, Oregon Health Authority, Medicaid, et cetera, have handed this one little institution housed in a house $2.3 million, and that while they were doing this, at least two of the people inside that program were accused of taking off in a car, kidnapping, torturing, robbing, and attempting to murder a woman in Seattle. Now, if that's what's going on with one of their programs, should we have any good reason to suspect it may be happening more broadly than that?
Yes, very good reason, Lars. The $2.3 million that we know Uplifting Journey received from the state of Oregon is very, very likely the tip of a very large iceberg. And that's because the $2.3 million is probably a fraction of what Uplifting Journey got from the state of Oregon, because most of those dollars would flow through a coordinated care organization, which is kind of a nonprofit intermediary, which is immune from public records request laws. So there probably was a lot more than $2.3 million. That flowed to just this one entity from the state of Oregon in Medicaid funds that we don't know about. There just happened to be this blip of reimbursements directly from OHA in 24 and 25 that we were able to pin down with a records request.
I mean, Jeff, is it unreasonable for citizens like me who pay our taxes to say, if you were handing $2.3 million to any entity, to any business, to any organization, that you'd have some idea of what was going on there? I mean, this isn't somebody, you know, running from a state office down to the office supply store, buying a few reams of paper or a toner cartridge. You're talking about a fairly sizable amount of money going to what? An organization, Uplifting Journey, that was housed in a house in Lake Oswego. I mean, it begins to sound like what we've heard out of Minnesota, where people figured out all you need is a mailbox and tell them you're running a daycare and or even an adult care institution, and they'll send you piles and piles of money.
Yeah, no, that's more or less what happened. In Uplifting Journey, they had an office in Portland. It was closed down. So the parallels to what happened in Minnesota are many. And the state of Oregon didn't really care about it until we reported on it. And then State Rep Ed Deal sent them a letter. It was the next day after he sent his letter that they stopped those reimbursement payments to Uplifting Journey. But like I said, that $2.3 million is very likely the tip of the iceberg, and there are probably many, many other business entities doing what Uplifting Journey did.
I mean, Jeff, you're an attorney. I'm not. But doesn't this sound like money laundering, where the state of Oregon says we want to give money out, but if we give it out directly from a state agency, then people like Jeff Eager and others, Ed Deal, can come in and say we'd like to see the records, their public record. But if they hand it first to an NGO or a nonprofit, like this appears to be, that all of a sudden that money and any records associated with it disappear from public view. That's a money laundry, isn't it?
It's a huge problem, Lars, because we have billions and billions of dollars in Medicaid funds flowing through these CCOs with no transparency, zero transparency. And it's, you know, it's, I don't know what it, if it was intended that system was intended to conceal fraud.
I think,
but in practice, that's what it does.
Well, and Jeff, would it have been impossible for the state bureaucracy, whether the legislature ordered it or not, to say, if you're going to hand out this kind of cash, then even though the private organizations are immune to public records laws, we're going to insist that those private organizations that are getting these piles of cash have to share their records with state agencies who will then make them available as public records. They could write that right into the agreement, couldn't they?
They could, and they should. CCOs should be subject to public records request laws, absolutely.
And that could be done by the, and tell me if I'm wrong, but I understand the legislature could order this, and that might be the best way to do it. But if the governor, the person who's in charge of the executive branch of government, simply said, don't hand out more than $50,000 or $20,000, whatever, a small sum, the minute you hand out a big sum, the organization you handed to is required to turn their records over about how much money they got, what they did with it, what results they produced. And if they won't hand the info over to a state agency that makes the public records available, then we're not paying the money. Then you're not qualified for the contract. Any more, Jeff, than if I apply for a mortgage and the mortgage company, a regulated institution says, Lars, we need to see your last 3 years of tax records, which they routinely do. Okay, I hand them to them. We'd like to see bank statements for the last 3 months. We'd like to see this. We'd like to see that. They ask for all that, and if you say, I'm not willing to give it, you don't get the mortgage, right?
Yeah, absolutely. There's all kinds of stuff that Tina Kotek could do if she really wanted to tackle this problem. I think the underlying issue is that she doesn't, and the other Democrats who run the state of Oregon don't want to deal with this. We've been hounding them for information and comment on this whole thing for going on a year now, and they've given us as little as they possibly can. They don't want to focus on this, and they don't want Oregonians to know about this likely huge problem of Medicaid fraud that Oregonians and Americans are paying for right now.
Well, and does it make it even less likely we're going to get any answers because Tina Kotek right now is in a battle for her political life? She's been dumped by the labor unions, the teachers unions, the working families don't want to endorse her. She's like a dead political character walking politically, and she's likely to lose the election. So she's not exactly going to go out and say, I'm going to dig into this and tell the public what's going on.
No, I think the Democrats have decided that, you know, they're going to roll this thing back out for this election season, Lars. And she didn't draw a serious Democrat opponent in the primary, which would indicate that that party is looking to do something else. They're not. And they're going to try to roll it back with this same style of governance, which is hide stuff that is inconvenient to them and try to restrict the flow of information to benefit their electoral chances.
Absolutely. That's Jeff Eager, former mayor of Bend, attorney, political consultant. You can find what he writes at Oregon Roundup on Substack. In a moment, I'll get to your phone calls and emails. And a California governor candidate says illegal aliens can make a lot of money.
LarsLarson.com. That's talk at LarsLarson.com. Now, to the Lars Larson Show.
Welcome back to the program. It's a pleasure to be with you on a First Amendment Friday. I got to tell you something, because during election years, we get a whole lot of crazy going on everywhere. And let me give you a few examples, because this stuff is just almost off the charts. So, let's start with a state like Minnesota. Now, in Minnesota, it's a very liberal blue state, and they don't believe that there's anything wrong with abortions. And so they have voted in their legislature time and again that unborn babies don't have any rights. So it might surprise you that Minnesota is now leading the way to trying to establish the inherent right to life of wild rice. Now, if you think you misheard me, you did not. Wild rice and the inherent right to life of wild rice. Take a listen to Minnesota's Jessica Intermill.
First, this bill applies the legal inherent rights doctrine to a plant that has been in Minnesota since long before there was a Minnesota. That doctrine does not grant any right to wild rice. Rather, it recognizes that the plant's inherent right to live exists because it is alive.
Now, what's crazy about that, this is, as I said, she is an attorney for the Wild Rice Act and the current legislation talking about the inherent rights that because wild rice is alive, that it has an inherent right to be alive. Apparently, Minnesota can apply that kind of thinking to grains of rice that we're pardoning. This is wild rice. It's not the stuff that they raise to become Uncle Ben's, but they will not apply it to children. And then take a listen to this. I love this soundbite from Representative Lisa McClain of Michigan in this case, because in almost every Democrat-driven state in America, they are demanding giant piles of additional cash in the form of taxation. And all the time the Democrats are saying, why, we're concerned about affordability. What they mean is they'd like rent to be lower. They'd like groceries to be lower. They'd like gasoline to be lower. I would as well. But they're not concerned about keeping the cost of government down. And I think Lisa McClain really said it right. Take a listen.
Every single Democrat voted to raise your taxes. Every single Democrat wants the government to keep more of your money.
I couldn't agree with her more. And then we'll go to California, because California has a governor's race, because Gavin Newsom is going to be leaving the governor's office. I think he plans to run for president of the United States. But given the kind of devastation that has happened in California, I don't think Gavin Newsom has much chance of becoming president unless you have people who say, wow, we're really impressed by what Gavin Newsom did to California, and we want him to do to the rest of the United States what he has done to California. But one of the candidates, who is Alicia Lapp, who's running for California governor, she's making the argument that right now in California, if you're an illegal alien, you can actually go to the state and say, I'd like to sign up as a foster parent, and you get a big pile of money. Listen to her explain.
To the illegals that are currently foster parents right now, as the next governor of California, I will be ending that.
Yeah, and why? Because she says if you sign up as a foster parent in the state of California, that you will get as much as $3,200 every month, regardless of whether or not you're even legally in the United States. Oh, and then, we've got to talk about this. Democrat Arizona State Senator Catherine Miranda, who lashes out at a student athlete. Now, why? This young lady stood up, student athlete, and she was trying to say it is not equitable for young women to have to compete against biological men who call themselves trans women. And take a listen to what this state senator says to her. She basically says, you're being a wuss.
I mean, you look pretty healthy. I've played against girls that look like you. You look very much in shape and strong. But it's a sports mentality when you're growing up and how much competition that you'll take on. So it's not just a silver bullet for one community of sports players. It's the individual person on how competitive you want to be. So you grew up one way. I grew up a different way. I would have taken on a man in a heartbeat.
Yeah, so she's saying you, as a woman, you should be prepared to compete against men. And if you're not ready to compete against men, maybe you're just not trying hard enough. Well, the girl athlete made a very good case, because what they're trying to do, this is in the state of Arizona, is they want to pass a bill that, if passed, will be sent to the ballot. It'll be voted on by the people of Arizona. And it simply says we will protect girls in sports, meaning girls in sports won't have to compete against males who are pretending to be girls in sports. Here's the way that young lady explained it.
As elite level athletes, I would say we're very competitive, which is why this bill designates three categories: male, female, and co-ed. The idea is that everyone can participate in sport. If you want to compete against your man, absolutely. Like, let's do that in the co-ed section. That's the clarity and distinction is really important, because when men are allowed access into women's sports and spaces, it's not women's sports and spaces anymore.
No, it's not. And then I want to do this. Democrat Senator Elisa Slotkin one of the members of Congress who voted to shut down Department of Homeland Security, even as we've had three different terrorist attacks in the last 7 days in the United States in various different locations. She knows that ICE is already funded, but she admits the Democrats need to reopen DHS at a time when terrorists are attacking in our country.
Certainly in Michigan, we have a ton of DHS folks, CBP, and so they are on the call and they're doing their jobs. Certainly, we need to fund the Department of Homeland Security, and we need, in my view, to cut away all the conversation on ICE, which is its own conversation, from all the core missions of the Department of Homeland Security. But they're essential, they're on the job, they're working today.
Yeah, and that's a Democrat admitting Homeland Security has to be funded. The fact that TSA is not right now is a decision of the Democrats. Let me go to Ralph on this First Amendment Friday. Ralph, what's on your mind?
Well, what's on my mind, Lars, is about the KC-135 that went down.
Yes, sir.
Okay. Now, I pulled this info from aerospaceglobalnews.com, article of today, and they do quote U.S. CENTCOM as saying that two aircraft were involved.
That's right, but people have been assuming the other aircraft is a KC-135. Anytime there's refueling, there's a KC-135, and then the aircraft it's fueling, I believe, the collision.
The Lars Larson Show. The Lars Larson Show? Get the podcast right now at LarsLarson.com. Now, more with Lars Larson.
Welcome back to the Lars Larson Show. It's First Amendment Friday. We'll get back to your calls in a moment at 866-HEY-LARS. That's 866-439-5277. Naysayers always go to the head of the line. A brand new investigation says that thousands, at least thousands of non-citizens have ended up on the voter rolls in multiple states, and officials have resisted requests to turn over the records to find those people. Well, Mateo Ferrero is the Director of Investigations for the Federation for American Immigration Reform, FAIR. Mateo, good to have you back.
Lars, good afternoon. Thank you for having me on the show.
You know, I almost think you're understating it, and I'll tell you why. One of your unexpected, unlikely allies is Chuck Schumer, because just this week, Chucky came out and said, what if we pass the SAVE Act and insist on, on voter registration with citizens only and picture ID and all the rest of that? He said we're going to have to take tens of millions of people off the voter rolls. I mean, I don't know whether you ever expected Chuck Schumer would be one of your allies, but it appears he is.
Yeah, Lars, Chuck Schumer has made some interesting statements this week in opposition to the Save America Act, which, by the way, we urge Congress to pass without delay, because it really is the legislation that's going to cure a lot of the deficiencies that we outlined in our report. So,
by the way, would you mind telling my audience, you've identified eight of the worst offender states in America. Which states are they?
That's right. So we looked at eight states in particular. That's California, Colorado, Hawaii, Nevada, Oregon, Vermont, Washington, and the District of Columbia. And these eight jurisdictions have what we call a dangerous trifecta of policies. That is, automatic voter registration, they issue licenses to illegal aliens, and they have universal mail-in voting. These policies have been enacted under the guise of creating administrative convenience and easing the ability to vote. But what they actually do in practice is create an easy pipeline for non-citizens to get on the voter rolls and actually cast ballots.
And are they taking any kind of steps that you would expect somebody to take, an entity to take, to make sure that their voter rolls do not have foreign nationals on them?
Right. So that was, you know, the main thrust of our investigation is we asked these eight states, election officials, as well as DMV officials in all of these jurisdictions, you know, hey, provide us with any policies or studies, data that you've gathered, to try to implement guardrails to make sure that these policies aren't running up against your compliance obligations under federal law, under the National Voter Registration Act, to only have citizens on the voter rolls. And unfortunately, what we discovered was, rather than get, you know, documents and responses, is we got a lot of stonewalling. I mean, I'll give you one of the crazier examples. The Colorado Secretary of State told us that it would take 180,000 man hours to process our request, and that it would cost FAIR $6.2 million to process the request, which is just absolutely, you know, absurd, and clearly shows that they're trying to hide something. Clearly, they, you know, haven't thought about, you know, the need to have safeguards to ensure that these policies they've adopted aren't, you know, allowing non-citizens to cast ballots in American elections.
Hey, Mateo, do you mind if you don't mind, I try to break things down so it's easier for me to understand it. 180,000 hours. If I've done the math right, you're talking about 90 people working full time. That's 2,000 hours a year. 90 people working full time for a year just to break loose all this data. That's what they're claiming.
Yeah. That's what they're claiming, Lars. And, you know, it just makes no sense because the public records requests that we submitted were very specific and targeted, had, you know, particular search terms that these agencies could use to search through their public records. And so we made it, you know, incredibly accessible and easy for these agencies to provide us answers. And unfortunately, that's not what we received in return.
But then again, Colorado was the state. Remind my audience what they did, because they do have they have automatic voter registration. But if you get a driver's license and you're a non-citizen, in some cases you may not have been registered to vote. They actually sent out a notice telling 30,000 foreign nationals to register.
That's right, Lawrence. Yeah, we documented that case in our investigative report. The state of Colorado DMV. And election officials, they sent out 30,000 notices to, you know, non-citizens, you know, providing them the information necessary to register to vote. They teed it up as, oh, this was a glitch. But what in reality is, it shows that they clearly have no guardrails in place to prevent these types of errors from occurring. And when these errors occur, it's just ripe ground for individuals to take advantage of the system. You know, and especially in an automatic voter registration jurisdiction where, it relies on self-attestation, which means all you have to do is, you know, state under penalty of perjury that you're a U.S. citizen, but there's no actual, you know, requirement or even effort, by many of these states that have AVR to, you know, verify whether the person is lying or not. And so that's allowed, you know, really egregious incidents. I mean, just last week, there was the news about the Mauritanian national who was arrested in Philadelphia for having voted in 6 different federal elections over the past 20 years. So just goes to show you the depth of the problem here that we're facing.
Well, and that they don't want to solve the problem. And that has to be deliberate, isn't it? Because I would think if you're running a voter registration system and you understand the laws, only citizens can vote. You would think they would want to find all the non-citizens or the people not qualified to vote and kick them off the rolls. It sounds like you're running into a real headwind when it comes to this because they don't want to kick the foreign nationals out of the system.
Absolutely. And that's, you know, it's really a problem because every time a non-citizen is able to vote, it is canceling out the voice of an American citizen whose birthright it is to vote in American elections. And so it's a massive problem. And, you know, obviously, not to mention it's illegal under federal law. It's a crime to vote in federal elections if you're a non-citizen. So, yeah, there's absolutely every incentive to fix the problem. But, you know, certain states that are driven by anti-borders agenda just, you know, want to stick their head in the sand and not actually try to solve the problem.
Unbelievable. That's Mateo Ferrero. He is the director of investigations at the private organization known as the Federation for American Immigration Reform. We've done events with FAIR over the years, gone back to Washington, D.C., feet to the fire on Capitol Hill, and you can tell eight states in America: California, Colorado, Hawaii, Nevada, Oregon, Vermont, Washington, and the District of Columbia, that all say, yeah, we know we've got foreign nationals registered to vote, and we don't want to find them. You've got the Lars Larson Show.
Peace. 866-HEY-LARS. That's 866-HEY-LARS. Now, back to the Lars Larson Show.
Welcome back to the Lars Larson Show. One of the things I've been trying to do today, and that is bring you up to date on the accident that cost the lives of six different service members. They were flying on board a KC-135 refueling plane. I've actually had the opportunity to be on one of those planes during refueling. I've also been on a helicopter that was being refueled from, I think in that case, it was a C-130 that was refueling the aircraft that we were on. But I'm getting a lot of people saying, well, it sounds like two KC-135s. Can I tell you why I don't think that's what CENTCOM or the Pentagon is saying? What the Pentagon and CENTCOM have said is this aircraft was damaged, it crashed, the six people on board died, that it was an accident involving two aircraft. And people are reading that to mean, well, if it's two aircraft, it must be two KC-135s. I think logic would tell you otherwise, and I'll tell you why. They say this was not due to friendly fire, it was not due to enemy fire. Is there any reason for two KC-135s to be in close proximity? The answer is generally no. I mean, they might be in the same theater of operations, but there's no reason for them to be very close together. Is there a reason for a KC-135 to be near the aircraft it is refueling? And you say, well, of course, Lars, because the refueled aircraft has to come up behind, catch that hose in, you know, and then plug in. So that it can refuel. There is a reason for a KC-135 to be very close to the aircraft that it is refueling. So when CENTCOM says this involved a collision between two aircraft, and people are reading that to say, well, that means it must be two KC-135s. Ask yourself, is there any good reason that air traffic control, which over a theater like this one, where the United States owns the airspace over Iran, and Iran has no presence in that airspace at all. They have very good aircraft up high that use sophisticated radar to keep track of everything going on below. Why would you put two KC-135s in close proximity so they might collide? On the other hand, the plane that is being refueled from the KC-135 has to be close to the KC-135. When CENTCOM says this involved two aircraft, I read that to mean it is likely a collision that happened between the KC-135 and one of the aircraft it was refueling. They said the second aircraft was able to land safely, and thank God for that. Sadly, six lives were lost on board the KC-135 refueling plane. So that's the logic I would apply to it. If I'm wrong, I'm completely willing to correct that if that's not the right impression. Let's go to Troy in Oak Harbor. Hey, Troy, thanks for listening on the Radio Northwest Network. What's on your mind?
I'm deeply concerned and worried that I'm really disappointed in our state legislature for approving this state income tax. And after Ferguson signs it, I'm really worried about the likelihood of it surviving either the voters or a legal challenge. I hope it fails.
I hope it fails too. Although Troy, one of those two is not even possible. The one where you say it survives the voters, because they put, as I understand, they put an emergency clause on it, which means it cannot be referred right now to the voters. Oregon is in the middle of one of those right now where the legislature did not put an emergency clause on it. It was quickly referred to the voters, and the Democrats know to a fair certainty the voters are going to shoot it full of holes in the vote in May or in the vote in November. But in Washington state, the voters won't get to vote on this. So the court challenge would have to be the successful one. I, too, think that this income tax is going to be found to be unconstitutional. But what we would hope for is that the courts would say, because you passed this and because it appears to violate the Constitution, we're not going to let you put it into effect until it's been tested in court. The bad news is the courts in Washington state are largely owned by the Democrat Party. Because the Democrat Party appointed most of the Supreme Court, if not all of it, the appeals courts and everything else. So I don't know whether we're going to win. The Washington State Supreme Court has signed off on some crazy stuff that clearly violates the Constitution, but they own their allegiance and their jobs to the Democrats. So in this case, we may not get what we want. And then the second test, Roy, is this. If this thing has been put into effect because there are Democrat majority in one house, a large number of Democrats in the other house, the House and the Senate. When we get to the election, when we get to both the primary and the general, are Washington state voters going to return people to Olympia who voted for this thing? If they do, then what you're being told in effect is that in a representative form of government, the people wanted the taxes raised. And I think it's a crazy thing. It's going to cause an awful lot of people to leave the state of Washington, including those people who are in the best position to start new businesses, to expand existing businesses. And you're already seeing Howard Schultz, longtime liberal, founder of what is now Starbucks. He bought a small, couple of coffee shops in Seattle and grew them to Starbucks, which is 40,000 shops worldwide. And he's made his billions, and he's now saying, having promoted the liberal, point of view or the liberal policies in the state of Washington, he's now moving to Florida, a notoriously conservative state. What does that tell you?
Can I make one comment here, too? I read this in the Everett Washington Fish wrapper that a referendum, there's no chance of a referendum, but there still can be an initiative.
It'll just take longer, because if this was just referred to the people, then you could refer to it quickly. But I think the people in both Olympia and Salem, they don't want the people voting on this stuff, Troy. That's why they throw those emergency clauses on them, to tell the voters, we're passing this, we know you hate it, we know you're likely to vote it down, and that's why we're not going to let you quickly vote it down. And Troy, I don't think very much time is going to go on at all. They're originally saying this is a millionaire tax. How long do you think it's going to stay a millionaire tax before they start ratcheting down the numbers, saying, well, if you make $700,000 a year, if you make $500,000 a year, if you make $300,000 a year, that's the way the U.S. income tax got to where it is today. It was originally just a tax on the very, very rich. And instead, today it basically applies to everybody who gets a paycheck. Troy, thanks for the call from Oak Harbor. It's First Amendment Friday, and you're listening to the Radio Northwest Network. This segment of the show brought to you by NickShivers.com. To sell your house immediately, go to NickShivers.com.
The Lars Larson Show.
You need when you want it. FM News 101 KXL is Portland's number one source for news and information. KXL FM, Portland, Vancouver, Salem.
This is CBS News on the Hour, sponsored by JTV.com.
I'm Jennifer Kuiper. U.S. Attorney Jeanine Pirro blasts a federal judge for blocking a pair of Justice Department subpoenas issued to the Federal Reserve in January. Fed Chair Jerome Powell revealed the subpoenas were part of its investigation into him. Pirro stresses,
this outrageous decision will be appealed by the United States Department of Justice.
Judge James Boasberg wrote in part that the government has offered no evidence that Powell committed any crime other than displeasing President Trump by not lowering the key interest rate fast enough. CBS News senior justice reporter Sarah Lynch.
When it comes to a grand jury subpoena, it is an incredibly high burden to show why it should be quashed. And this action in and of itself is highly unusual and not something you see day to day in any federal court.
Trump ally Rick Grenell is stepping down as Kennedy Center president. The change is expected to be announced on Monday. Matt Flocka, the vice president of facilities operations, is expected to succeed Grenell. Questions continue over how long the U.S. will continue the war against Iran.
Concerns are growing over U.S. casualties and rising oil prices, even as the U.S. military is sending some 2,500 Marines and at least one more warship to the Middle East. On the Brian Kilmeade Show, President Trump was asked about the war's impact on the economy. The president said, quote, "This is going to bounce back so fast." As for when he's going to know when the war is over, Trump responded, quote, "When I feel it. When I feel it in my bones," unquote. Linda Kenyon, CBS News, the White House.
Sources in Lebanon tell a freelance journalist for CBS News two brothers of the suspect in yesterday's Michigan synagogue attack, who were recently killed in a Lebanon airstrike, were Hezbollah members. CBS's Usher Qureshi has more from West Bloomfield, Michigan.
Federal officials have identified the suspect as Ayman Muhammad Ghazali. He was born in Lebanon, actually, in 1985, and then became a citizen later on. The Department of Homeland Security says he entered the United States legally in 2011 on a spousal immigrant visa and became a naturalized citizen in 2016.
The FBI is investigating the case. This year's flu season is winding down after a not-so-hot vaccine. CBS's Cammy McCormick reports.
A new strain that was prevalent during the early winter months was not well matched to the vaccine, and that led to an intense early onslaught of flu. Officials are generally pleased if a flu vaccine is 40 to 60% effective, but this year's shots were about half that. In fact, it had one of the lowest effectiveness rates in the last two decades. A flu expert says the season is now coming to a close, and he's very grateful for that.
This is CBS News.
Looking for spring jewelry looks? Find them at Jewelry Television. New customers get $20 off purchases of $99 or more at JTV.com.
To First Amendment Friday on the Lars Larson Show.
Friday is for everybody.
Today, Lars puts you in the driver's seat. You talk about what you want to talk about.
Government is the problem.
No topic is off limits.
It looks like the Canadians are here.
Call 866-HEY-LARS. That's 866-HEY-LARS.
Thank goodness it's Friday. Happy Friday. This is
First Amendment Friday with Lars Larson.
Welcome back to the Lars Larson Show. It's a pleasure to be with you on my favorite day of the week, First Amendment Friday. We open up the phone lines and every subject is fair game. And of course, I got a few things I want to comment about. If you want to jump into the best conversation in talk journalism, happens right here every weekday at 866-HEY-LARS. And if you're a naysayer, we put you right to the head of the line at 866-439-5277. Send your emails to talk@larslarson.com. So, terrible situation that we've talked about on this show before, a 2022 incident 3 years, now 4 years ago, very nearly, in which a sheriff's deputy shot and killed an off-duty police officer because the sheriff's deputy mistook him for a robbery suspect. And now a payout has been arranged of $7.5 million for that wrongful death. I thought we'd talk to our friend Angus Lee, who's an attorney in Washington State. Angus, welcome back to the program.
Hey, Lars. Thank you for having me.
Is there any question? I mean, I always tell people if a lawsuit is going to be brought, it's usually by the person injured against the people who did the injury. But if the injury was a pure and simple a mistake, and a mistake was made, is this kind of settlement something that is absolutely necessary? And should the taxpayers be funding the cost of it?
Yeah, that's a great question. And the answer is sure, absolutely. And the reason is, one of the things that we do in our legal system and in our country is we recognize when someone has harmed another person negligently, even if they didn't intentionally do it or recklessly do it, but they were negligent and they caused harm to someone else, we make them whole as best we can. And so an easy way to think about that is, if a police officer is driving his car down the road faster than he should, and he causes an accident and hurts somebody, we say, you know, that person that was hurt when that police officer was driving too fast, they should be made whole. They should be compensated. They shouldn't have to suffer that loss on their own. And that applies in situations where the police are driving too fast or when they're shooting too fast.
Well, in fact, couldn't it actually apply even further than what you said? You said, say the officer is driving too fast. Let's say the officer is appropriately responding beyond the speed limit to an emergency, which justifies that speed. Even if he's doing everything right and then somebody ends up killed, you're going to see a settlement, right?
Yeah, absolutely. And as a society, I think we all recognize we want that. We need law enforcement, and we need law enforcement to be able to do their job. At the same time, we don't want the person who's accidentally hit when the officer is responding at high speed to be the one that bears the loss of what society needs, you know, individually. We all want to make that person whole or their family whole as best we can, because we do want police to be able to respond and do their job. But when bad things happen to good people, we want those people taken care of.
Well, and I guess the answer to not having these kind of mistakes made or accidents happen is proper training, because isn't that always going to come up as the question is, and when you said he shot too fast? Segura had apparently stabbed Officer Sahota as they were wrestling in his driveway after he'd been mistaken, and one of the deputies got out of his patrol vehicle and shot Sahota, mistaking him for the criminal suspect, and then Sahota died from the gunshot wound. So that's what happened, and that it was potentially avoidable, right?
Yeah, it was actually totally avoidable. And like you're talking about, part of it is we want officers to have the best training, and we also want them to have the best policies and procedures. And one of those policies and procedures that a county law enforcement agency should have is one that trains their deputies on how to deal with situations where you have plainclothes officers on scene when you're responding. Unfortunately, Clark County didn't have a policy or training protocol for those situations, which all experts in police procedures recognize that law enforcement agencies should have. And I think Clark County will have that going forward.
I guess what makes me, because I think, you know, in the case of somebody harmed, in this case, the family lost a family member and it shouldn't have happened. I think somebody should have to pay for the damage that you've done to that family. What bothers me about this, Angus, is that the folks who will pay this tab are not the ones who made the decision, meaning the county officials who made the bad call or failed to have the right kind of training in place. They don't lose personally. It's only the taxpayers who pay the bill. Whereas, you know, if I went out and I hurt somebody with my actions, I get sued. I have to pay the tab, or my insurance does, but then I have to pay, you know, I have to pay increased premiums and things like that. Or the damages might be big enough that they say, we're going to take your house and everything you've got because you have to pay this damage. It hits me personally. These kinds of suits don't hit the officials who made the bad decisions, do they?
No, they don't. And, you know, in our structure of society and government, I always tell people there's some limits to what the legal system can do, and that's where the electoral process system kicks in. And so it's a political solution. So when people see that their county elected officials didn't do their job of putting proper policies and procedures and training in place, once you've made the family whole that's been injured, that's when you look at, hey, do we need to address this in the electoral process to get better elected officials to do the job?
You know what I'd almost prefer, Angus? I'd prefer a system in which any time a county gets sued because or a city, that when there have been gaps, that the person or the persons who made the judgment call, we don't need that training, we don't want to give that training, that person has to take a piece of whatever the action is. You know, as opposed to just saying, well, the county is going to have to pay this, but you don't lose a dime. You don't suffer a bit, even if you were the one who said, you know, you as a police official or a county official said, we're not going to have that kind of training, and it's my job to decide it. Say you're a county administrator or an elected sheriff. those people, should they have to pay something?
Yeah, you raise a really interesting point about how in our structure of government, the decision makers are very far removed from the consequences of their decisions.
Yep.
And the political scientists have analyzed this and discussed it and found the closer you tie the consequence to the person making the decision, the more responsive that person is to the consequences and more involved they become in making the right decision. So definitely.
Yeah. That's the thinking I would have, Angus, is if you said, if your city ever ends up or county gets sued for $7.5 million, you're going to take 10% of it. Personally, you're going to pay $75,000. So I would think that would get your attention. That is Angus Lee. He's an attorney in Washington State talking about the $7.5 million payout that is being paid to the family of a man mistakenly killed by a wrong.
Would you?
Have something to say but don't want to talk? Email Lars at talk@larslarson.com. Now, back to the Lars Larson Show.
Welcome back to the program. It's a pleasure to be with you. I'm glad to get to your phone calls and emails. It's a First Amendment Friday live on the Radio Northwest Network. And if you want to call, it's 866-HEY-LARS. And if you're a naysayer, we love naysayers on this show. For almost 30 years, we've always put naysayers to the head of the line at 866-439-5277. So let's go first to Tim. Tim, you told my producer, Joel Maha, and he deserves credit, he's a great producer, that you're a naysayer. Yeah. What do you and I disagree about that makes you a naysayer?
I was just curious, is modern conservatism being scared of stuff? Is that what we're doing now?
No.
We're all just scared
what would make you, no, the answer is no, Tim. What would make you believe that?
Just like, I've been listening to you the past couple of days, and it just sounds like you're scared of stuff that isn't really going on.
Can you give me a good example of something where I came on the air and said, I'm really terrified of this, and I don't know what's going on.
No, you're not terrified. No.
Well, okay, I'm scared. Okay, tell me the thing you think I'm scared of.
I think you're scared of things that aren't happening.
Well, then give me an example of one of these, I guess, non-existent things that I'm scared that you think I'm scared of. I'd love to hear it.
Well, earlier today, we were talking about tipping earlier.
Yeah.
Why
were we talking? Because tipping is a common practice in America, but it's been perverted.
Correct.
It's been perverted lately, where instead of simply getting a tip,
how?
I was trying to answer your question, but if you don't want to hear it, that's okay. What were you going to say? Why were we talking about tipping? Because tipping, and I'll tell you something, Tim, one of the phenomena just in the last couple of years has been a young man or woman putting a screen in your face, usually on an iPad, that says, how big a tip would you like to leave? And you're offered the choice of none, 20%, 25%, 30%.
Yeah.
Tim,
yeah.
Let me ask you a personal question. Have you ever asked a friend or family member for a gift?
This is what you were saying earlier.
Let's ask, what is a tip? Is it a gratuity? And is a gratuity a gift that you give somebody? In other words, if I have somebody mow my lawn and I've agreed to pay a kid $30 a week to mow my lawn, when he comes up after mowing my lawn and says, Mr. Larson, I'm done with the lawn, can I have my $30? He's asking to be paid for a service that I agreed to pay a fee for. But when a tip is asked for, you're asking somebody for a gift. Now, have you ever in your life said to your friends, by the way, it's my birthday this Friday, would you please give me a gift?
I don't think that it's the same thing.
How so? Then explain to me the difference between a gratuity and a gift, which means gift. How is it not a gift?
So I think you, man, wow.
Kind of got lost on that one, didn't you?
No, I mean, I think you have decided but it's bad.
That what's bad? Asking for a gift? Yes. Bad. Tim, I think that prior to all this POS sales stuff, I don't mean the other POS, but I mean point of sale, that prior to that, if you had a waiter or a waitress walk up to you and say, by the way, I gave you guys fantastic service tonight, and I certainly would hope that you would give me a sizable tip. And what would you say to that waiter? What would you say to that waiter or waitress?
Is the screen saying that to you?
Yes, it is. It's saying, I took your order for a cup of coffee. You haven't even received the cup of coffee yet. You don't know if the cup of coffee, you don't know if the cup of coffee is going to be on time. You don't know if it's going to be an inaccurate error fulfillment. You may have ordered one thing, they give you something else. That happens from time to time. If somebody gets your order completely wrong, do they still deserve a tip?
I think you should just...
No, Tim. You know what? You've been belligerent enough. Answer my question first, because I've answered yours.
What was the question then?
And please listen. If somebody gets your order completely wrong at a restaurant or a service, do they deserve a tip?
Then you just shouldn't be tipping.
Well, hold on. No, Tim. I believe I've given very generous tips on occasion. And I've given moderately generous tips. I think tips are completely appropriate, but they are the decision of you. Just like... Tim, have you ever asked your friend, I'll go back to my original question. Have you ever gone to your friends and said, I've been a great friend to you. I want you to buy me a really nice Christmas present.
But that's not what's happening.
Have you ever done that? Have you ever done that?
No.
Then what is a tip if a tip, if a gratuity is not a gift, what is it?
A gratuity is a way of paying extra.
I understand what paying extra is, but why would you pay extra? Have you ever gone in to buy a car and you arrived at a deal? I'll buy your car for $30,000. And when it comes down to the deal, you say, you know what? I've decided to pay you $35,000. Have you ever done that, Tim?
No.
Why wouldn't you?
Why tip at all?
No, because I tried to explain to you, Tim, I've tried to explain. I understand you're a liberal, so I'll make it as simple as I can. When you feel that someone, a young man or woman, has given you a service above and beyond what you'd ordinarily expect, if you walk into a restaurant and the lady walks over and says, what would you like? You say, I'd like ham and eggs, and she brings you ham and eggs, she's done the job. But if somebody does extraordinary service and says, goes above and beyond, and you say, that man or that lady deserves a tip as a thank you, a gratuity, a gift, because they went above and beyond. Is that understandable by you?
You want it on the receipt.
No, I don't want it on the receipt, because I don't think it's part of the transaction. If I walk in and it's $10 for ham and eggs, and I pay $10 for ham and eggs, why would you put the gift on the receipt?
That's where it goes. I mean,
no, the tip does not go on the receipt. The tip is a thank you to the person who went above and beyond usual service, right?
Yeah, that's
okay.
What it's for.
Then why would a service person ask you for the tip before you've even received the service?
They're not asking you.
Yes, they are. When they put a screen in your face and say, will you give me a tip of 20% or 30%, they're asking for the tip. And Tim, if you are too thick to understand that they are asking you for a tip, it does not surprise me that you are a liberal progressive. But I always appreciate a great naysayer. You got the Lars Larson Show.
The Lars Larson Show. Lars has you covered. Call him from anywhere. 866-HEY-LARS.
Now, back to the Lars Larson Show.
And First Amendment Friday on the Radio Northwest Network. It's a pleasure to be with you. And this segment of the show is always brought to you by Oregon Medical Centers, the regenerative medical specialist, Oregon Medical Centers. I want to start with a naysayer. I've got a couple of them, including Trust Fund Theodore. But let me start with Daniel. Daniel, what do you and I disagree about that makes you a naysayer?
Hi, Lars. Really enjoy your show.
Thank you.
On tipping, I had three of my four adult children were either bartenders or working restaurants, and they really wanted to do a good job always. They make them feel good about their work if they, you know, were successful in their work.
Yeah.
And almost always, if things went south or sideways, it was because of some other circumstance that was affecting their work, and so they got less tips. So I want to make an appeal for treating service workers in restaurants with mercy. And then I also want to make an appeal for just the
fact
that...
But we don't disagree on that, Daniel. I hope you know that. Because there have been times Tina and I have left a tip for a young lady or a young man where we realized everything was going south that day. I mean, the cook was late, other people made mistakes, stuff got dropped, and we realized it wasn't her fault, it wasn't his fault, and we factor that in. But I guess my question is, when you have a lot of businesses today where you do almost all the work, you walk up to the front, you put in your order, you have to go pick up your order, you may even have to fill up your drink, you have to pick your table, you put your stuff down, you eat, and you've done most of the work, is a tip expected in that kind of case?
Yeah, I understand that paradigm you're working with, the template you're working with logically, but I want to just throw out an additional idea, and that is, if minimum wage people are actually surprised, they can be actually surprised in a good way. And like if I go out to eat, it's a kind of a rare, cool thing, and I want to have a positive experience. Sometimes giving people that, even if they don't seem to deserve it, a surprise extra gift in a way where it's like, wow, I didn't expect that when things went south or I didn't, you know, something was off with me today. And then part of that experience of going out is the extra joy of giving them joy.
See, but hold on, Daniel. That's still very transactional because you're saying when I can enjoy you getting a tip, then I'm even more willing to get the tip. But what happens when somebody puts a screen in your face and tell me you haven't had that happen? You stop for a coffee and they show you a screen and it asks you for a tip. Is it ever right to ask for a tip?
Well, I just roll with the culture.
No. You're dodging the question, Daniel. Be honest.
Oh,
is it ever right to ask for a tip?
No, I agree with you that it's not right to ask, but I also think that there can be joy in giving extra just a surprise.
I totally agree with you on the extra joy. Let me go to Trust Fund Theodore. Hey, Trust Fund Theodore, how are you doing today? You're a naysayer. What's up? Theodore? You know, I was so looking forward to talking to the most famous or infamous graduate of Oregon Episcopal School, but apparently Theodore has decided to take off. Let's go to Armin, who's on the island, Maori Island, that we've talked about before. Armin, what's on your mind today?
Yeah, earlier, before two breaks back, I thought you made some great points to that one caller about asking for a gift and so on and so forth. I wanted to add two other nuances to the whole tip business because I find it annoying the same way you do. One is that you leave a tip and then you're charged sales tax on the tip.
Well, sounds like Maury Island's phone service wasn't so good. Let's go to Bruce in Bellingham. Hey, Bruce, what's on your mind today?
Hi, Lars. Yeah, back in 2024, during the governor's election here in Washington, I heard Ferguson, when he was a candidate, say that he didn't want to raise taxes. Well,
and he was lying, wasn't he? Wasn't he lying?
He was. That's the most deceitful way to state that I've ever heard of. And he's raised taxes twice now on us up here. Once in the budget for Washington State last year, and now this millionaire tax. It's a bunch of baloney. He's the most deceitful person I've ever listened to.
The most recent time that he did it was 2025, when Bob Ferguson promised that he would not raise taxes. But then what he did was he qualified it. by saying, I won't raise taxes below or for people who make less than $1 million. So already he was starting to qualify it and say, I will raise taxes, but only on the super rich. And Bruce, I think everybody is on to this game right now. If they're not on to the game, they ought to be. The very first income tax in America, actually it's the second one, but the one that stuck, the one in 1913, that one was promised as a very small income tax only on the super rich. And by super rich, I've told people before, and if you don't believe me, check the numbers. At the time of the passage of the 1913 income tax, the average person made $500 to $700 a year. I mean, there were people literally making $40 a month, $10 a week. And they were told by the federal government, we're going to pass an income tax, but it's going to be very small, 1%. It's only going to apply to people who make over $3,000 a year. Now, Bruce, it's tough to take yourself back or take yourself back to that kind of time. But imagine a time where the average person makes 500 to 700 bucks. And they're saying we're only going to tax people who make four or five or six times as much money as you do. And there it is. Is Theodore there, the naysayer? Nope, then we're going to drop him altogether. Let's go back to Maury Island and Armin. Hey, Armin, we got about a minute before the end of the hour. What's on your mind? You were saying that you don't like having sales taxes collected on a tip. And I agree with you. I mean, how do they justify it when it's not officially part of the transaction of whatever you're buying?
It's just the way the law works. If you put it on your credit card or whatever, as opposed to if you left a tip in cash separately, then you wouldn't be charged the sales tax. Yeah, the comment I was going to make when I unexpectedly got dropped the reception was, if you go out to a business dinner and you spend, say, $300, $1,000, whatever, the tip can be something considerable, and the sales tax alone could be $15, $20, $40, $50, or whatever. The second comment I was going to make that I find annoying is when that screen is turned around, typically or often, it starts at 18%, 20%, 25%, or yep. something else, or yep. no tip. And I resent that. It used to be 15% was tips. It's supposed to mean
to ensure prompt service.
To ensure prompt service.
And yeah. by the way, Armin, when they say this is to ensure prompt service and you haven't received the service yet, that seems especially wrong. It's First Amendment.
The Lars Larson Show.